Hare Krishna. Welcome back to our Rishopanishad course. We discussed Mantra 13 in three detailed classes, where we first discussed about demigod worship, then we discussed about Mayavad, and then we discussed about social service. So these three are the alternatives to Krishna that people can choose as objects of worship. And we discussed how all of them are ultimately futile. Now, the Ishopanishad goes to the next mantra, where it talks about how we can balance. Just because everything in the material world is temporary doesn't mean it all has to be rejected. It has to be utilized. So just as mantra 11 talked about a balance between Vidya and Avidya, this mantra will talk about balance between Sambhuti and Vinasha, Sambhuti and Asambhuti. So here the word Asambhuti doesn't refer to just temporary material things. It refers to that which is used for the service of Krishna in the material realm. So it refers to knowledge of this world, which helps us to become fixed in the service of Krishna, use it in the Krishna service of Krishna, and go back to the spiritual world. So let us look at the mantra. This is mantra 14. Sambhutim cha vinasham cha yastad vedo bhayam saha vinashena mrityam tirtva sambhutyam mritam ashnate. So earlier the word was sambhuti and asambhuti. So here asambhuti is replaced by vinasham. The two are cognate, they are more or less equivalent words in terms of their implications. Asambhuti is that which is temporary, vinasham is that which is temporary. So yastad vedo bhayam saha, veda, ubhaya, when one knows both of these, then a person will become free from what? Vinashena mrityum tirtva. That by knowledge of material world, one will navigate through the material world, through the ocean of immortality. Sambhutya amrita mashnute. By sambhuti, one will attain immortality. So Srila Prabhupada translates this as, one should know perfectly the personality of Godhead Shri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it. And in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. So Srila Prabhupada translates Sambhuti as the Lord along with his Nama Rupa Guna Lila. And then he translates Vinashena as a material creation with its own variety of living beings. So let us look at the purport now. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada basically talks about the first two paragraphs is Vinashena. Nothing can make this world deathless, not even science. And Sambhutim cha Vinasham cha. So Prabhupada's reasoning in this purport is that this world is temporary and science also cannot change the nature of this world. So then, what can we do? Is there a realm beyond death? Yes, there is. So Vedas give us information about the death-filled world and the death-free world. The death-filled world is this material world. Death-free world is the world beyond. So Krishna talks about this also in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he contrasts the temporary and the material and encourages Arjuna to strive for the eternal. So from 8.15 onwards till 8.22, he talks about the contrast. So 8.15 is Dukkhalema Shashvatam. Then 8.16 is Abrahma Bhuvanan Loka, right? From Brahma's planet down to the lowest, all are places of repeated birth and death. And then he talks about how even Brahma's lifespan ends. And then from 20 to 22, he talks about the spiritual world. To 8.20, he says, Parastasmat Bhavonyo, Tadadar Bhava. So this set of verses, 15 to 22, is illustrative of what Srila Prabhupada is saying over here, that the Vedas give information about the death-filled as well as the death-free world. Then Sambhutya Amrita Mashnute. Sambhutya Amrita Mashnute means only by surrender to Krishna can we transcend death. So this is talked about then in a more specific sense in the next verse, where it says, we have to give up misconceptions to attain immortality. So all of us can have various misconceptions. For example, I am the body is a prominent misconception. I am God is another misconception. So like that, there are many misconceptions which prevent us from attaining the shelter of God. So we have to give up these misconceptions by which we can ultimately attain immortality. When we attain God, automatically we attain immortality. Mamupetya punarjanma dukkhal vishashatam naapnuvanti. When we attain Krishna, as he says in 8.15, then we don't come back to this world. So attaining immortality means attaining Krishna, attaining love for Krishna, and attaining Krishna thereof. So in this class, we will primarily focus on understanding how the world, material world with its variety of time scales for different living beings is still ultimately mortal. So we will look at the concept of time, because time is a prominent reality in this world. Kalosmi lokakshaya krut pravrutto. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, time I am, the destroyer of the worlds. So let's look at this. So before that, Srila Prabhupada talks about the six, he calls these the six laws of transformation. We discussed this earlier also in our discussion on Mantra 11, that the living things and the non-living things, the difference is non-living things basically go only through three phases, creation, deterioration, destruction. Whereas living things go through three additional phases, growth, maintenance, reproduction, along with birth, deterioration and death. So now Srila Prabhupada in his purport calls these six as the six laws of transformation. Everything material has to get transformed through these six things. And because of that, because these six things can't be stopped, therefore, ultimately death can't be stopped. So this is how everything in the material world is unstoppably, irreversibly moving towards destruction and death. Let's look at the concept of time now to understand what is the implication of this death. So now, in today's mainstream society, there is the Judeo-Christian modern scientific time model. What is it? It is a linear approach from start to the end. So, for example, they say that at one particular point, there is a creation of universe. And then from there onwards, there is appearance of unicellular organisms. Then, it's all speculated exactly when it happened, how it happened, nobody knows. And then after some time, they say there is evolution of human beings. And now, after evolution, have we attained a peak or is something else going to happen after this? No one knows that. Maybe the way life is going, maybe we are going to devolve, maybe we are going to get destroyed. So it's all question. And then ultimately, researchers also say, no, that this world is not eternal. It's going to be destroyed. So how it is a linear model. Now, there have been science-religion wars in the West, centered on first the Copernican model, where the Catholic Church, based on a model of Ptolemy, which it had adopted into its own theology, proposed that the sun moves around the earth. So Ptolemy was a pre-Christian Greek thinker who had proposed such a model of the universe. And the Bible had more or less adopted, the biblical thinkers had more or less adopted it, Christian thinkers. And then when Copernicus opposed it, that was a big confrontation. And then Catholic Church took a big beating over there, because Galileo's discovery of the telescope, or invention of the telescope, and subsequent findings more or less gave very strong empirical evidence for the idea that the earth is moving around the sun, not the sun around the earth. Then after that, there was a big confrontation. This went on till Darwin's theory of evolution. And then there also, religion seemed to take a beating. So we may think that religion and science in the West have been in a state of conflict for almost 400 years. However, the Judeo-Christian worldview and the scientific worldview have many similarities. Both are linear. The Judeo-Christian worldview had the idea that all of history is moving towards a particular time. That time was the coming of Jesus. So St. Augustine was a prominent Christian thinker after Jesus. And he wrote a series of books in which he tried to prod history, rewrite, reshape history to fit a linear model. where everything, all events in history were progressing towards the appearance of Jesus. And after the departure of Jesus, now all the events are progressing towards the return of the Messiah. And when the Messiah returns, at that time, then there will be paradise on earth and all the sinners will be cast into hell. So basically, the Christian idea of the universe was itself a linear model. Now, before Jesus and before Augustine's writings, even in Europe, the Greek and the Roman model of universe was cyclic. And we see that most of nature around us, above us, in us, is cyclic. We see the sun rises, the sun sets. The moon has phases which keep waxing, waning. The seasons, summer, rainy season, winter, summer, rainy season, that's in India. Other places it might be, spring, autumn, the names may be different. But it's cyclic. Now we have morning, afternoon, evening, night, morning, afternoon, evening, night. So basically all of nature, we see it moves around in cycles. So in that sense, the linear view of time, as if time were an arrow progressing towards some particular point, was in a sense a Christian idea, and then science adopted it, and science simply replaced God and Jesus by the secular God, that is progress. So evolution theory basically starts from the idea that in the past everything was regressive, everything was very simplistic, there was no life at all. In fact, then there were microscopic organisms, and then from there it moved on, and then we have human being, we have animals, and then we have monkeys, and then we have human beings, and then as the human beings grow, evolve, and then now we have today's cell phone using, computer operating, car driving, and all the high tech emblazoned modern person. So it is actually a very self-serving model of history where we have planted ourselves at the top of history. That we are like we human beings and the modern human beings are the pinnacle of evolution. And if you think about it, this vision is radically opposed to the Vedic vision. Not only in the terms that Vedic vision is cyclic and this vision is linear, but in the cyclic Vedic vision, the current brand of humanity is not at the top. The current brand of humanity is at the bottom. There are four yugas, Satyuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Kaliyuga, and in that Kaliyuga is at the lowest. So the scientific version of history or vision of history, it's actually one version, not a true vision. So that is basically an outgrowth of the Christian idea of linear time, but with God replaced by secular concepts like natural selection and evolution and progress. Essentially, it is the same idea moved forward. So as contrasted with that, the Vedic idea is cyclic. Cyclic is, there's creation, maintenance, annihilation, and then there's creation, maintenance, annihilation. And once we understand the soul, then we understand this goes on life after life. So we know, that is, what is the basis of the cyclic idea? We understand that there is a way out of the cycle. We know that above, what you see above is the spiritual world with the Goloka Vrindavan at the top, then Vaikuntha is all around it, and the Brahma Jyoti, and below that is the material world, and we see the universe. So one of the problems with the cyclic model is that it appears as if there is no chance for progress. Because anyway, after morning, there is going to be night and darkness. Similarly, no matter how much we evolve, after Satyuga, there is going to be Kaliyuga. So this model seems to leave no room for human progress. And that's why many Western thinkers, they have often thought of the Vedic literature as very pessimistic and life-denying. However, the Vedic model does have room for progress, tremendous progress. But that progress is of a different nature. That is spiritual progress. So, rather than envisioning the progress in the material realm as a linear vertical progression, the Vedic scriptures accept the fact in nature that at a material level, what we call progress is basically cyclic. And what is progress now? We'll go down to regress and again progress. So in a sense, this vertical is like a horizontal one only. So it's a wheel here and it's moving round and round and round. And real progress is not to move toward the top part of the wheel. Even if one moves to top part, one will have to come back to the lower part. Instead, the progress is get out of the wheel. And there's a spiritual reality, where is eternal, where it is eternal. So, actually, human beings cannot live without the concept of progress. We all want to improve things. A cow can eat the same grass month after month, year after year, decade after decade. The cow doesn't think, oh, today I want to put some masala in the grass. I've been tasting the same thing for so long. The cow doesn't want new delicacies. The cow doesn't have any conception of progress. You know, it just does its eating, sleeping, waiting, defending. We human beings have a more evolved conception of life, more developed intelligence, and because of that we want to improve things. So modern society, by denying the spiritual dimension of reality, restricts the human idea of progress only to the material level. And in a sense, the last 5 centuries, and especially the last 1.5-2 centuries, have seen scientific progress at a feverish pace. So, as compared to 10 years ago, the technology then and technology now is phenomenally different. And this progress cannot be denied. There is progress, but there is a issue with it. The problem with it is that the human intelligence, which could have been used to come out of the cycle of birth and death, has simply been used to just go around a cycle of birth and death. So, at a material level, there might be progress, but at a material level, ultimately, there is no progress, because ultimately, everything is going to be destroyed. So, despite so much progress, we still have problems. We have huge technology, but still we have stressed people, we have distressed people, we have suicidal people, we have addicted people. So, we may be technologically improved, but psychologically, we have regressed. What to speak of spiritually? We definitely regress downwards. So, the modern idea of progress, by restricting our definition of progress to progress at the material level, has created this imbalance. Because people have no idea that they can progress at a spiritual level. What does progress at a spiritual level mean? It means increasing our understanding philosophically of spiritual reality, and it means increasing our experience of spiritual reality through the process of yoga, centered ultimately on bhakti yoga. So this enables us to experience spiritual reality. So when the Ishopanishad is telling that both have to balance, what does it mean? Do whatever is required for maintenance in the cyclic material world, but then focus on going beyond this world. So just like here, from the material world to the spiritual world you want to go. Now we'll try to understand how the material world things are cyclic ultimately. So this may seem a little complex at first glance, but you can start from the top. So we see there's the life of Brahma, it is gigantic. So 311 trillion years. Now what happens in that? So at the left is creation to destruction. On the top. Now, within that, if we take one kalpa is one day of Brahma. And Brahmaji has a year of 360 days. So 36,000 kalpas is his lifetime. So now, we take one kalpa from there and we expand it. So one kalpa is 4.32 billion years. So now, within that, there are 14 manvantaras and 15 sandhyas. Manvantara is the time duration of one Manu. And in between two Manvantaras, there is the Sandhya. Sandhya is like a joining period. And because it's in between two, so there are 15 Sandhyas. Now, we take one Manvantara and expand it in the next slide, next part of the slide. And there we will see that one Manvantara is 306.72 million years, that is 71 Divyugas. And at the beginning and at the end of that, there is Yuga Sandhya. So, juncture there is 1.728 million years. So, we describe what is the significance of this 1.28 million. And then, within one manvantara, there are 71 Divya Yugas. One Divya Yuga is one cycle of Satyuga, Tritha Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Kali Yuga, one set, which starts with Satyuga, ends with Kali Yuga, and again begins with Satyuga. So, now this is, Divya Yuga is 4.32 million years, four Yugas combined. In that there is Satyuga, Tritha Yuga, Dwapara Yuga and Kali Yuga. And in Kali Yuga, in the 4,50,000 years, right now only 5,000 years have passed. And that's where we are situated now. So, what is the age of Brahmaji now? It is 51st year, first month, first day. What does it mean? That actually, when we calculate his life from the beginning of the universe, this is the figure that we work out. And as we know, the 7th Manvantara and the 28th Divya Yuga. This is the time when Krishna appears in this world. So we modern man, as compared to the vastness of the universe, we are so small. And we are at this insignificant corner in the universe. These are technical things. We'll just look at this quickly. I'll not read all of it. Just look at the figure on the corner that you see. So every yuga has its yuga sandhya. So Kali Yuga has 360,000 years, 360,000 years as a central period. And there are 36,000 years that are in the beginning, 36,000 years in the end. So they are called the Sandhya. And the Sandhya is actually 1/10 the time of the Yuga in which it is. That means if the Yuga is, you see, it's 4,30,000 years, then this becomes 3,600 years. And both of them together, plus the central period of Yuga, that becomes the full time of the year, full time period of Yuga. Now, at the end of each manvantara, there is another Sandhya Kal, where a great flood wipes out most life on earth. At the end of Kalpa, all life on earth is destroyed, but the planets continue to exist. The souls of individuals, all souls, also continue to exist to be reincarnated in the next daytime of Brahma. You know that. It's not all souls are either liberated, definitely not. Those souls who remain, they can go to Brahma Loka. Now, at the end of the life of Brahma, there is Mahapralaya. First is called Naimittik, smaller pralaya. The whole universe is destroyed. The point of this is A Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravartino Arjuna. Everything in the world is destroyed. This is now again another some mathematics. Don't bother about the figures, just understand the principle here. So we are calling the time duration of Kali Yuga as K. So 4,30,000 years it is. So Dwapara Yuga is twice, Tritha Yuga is thrice, Satyuga Yuga is four times. So totally one Mahayuga or one Divya Yuga becomes 10K. K is the period of Kali Yuga. And one manvantara is 710K. Now each manvantara is preceded and followed by Sandhya Kal. So therefore the duration of the day of Brahma is calculated to be 1000 Mahayugas. Now similarly what one night? One day is 4.32 billion years, one day is 4.32 billion human years, because day and night are together. But they are continuous and in that sense they are different. They keep alternating. And 1 second is 100,000 human years. So you just think how tiny is our life as compared to the life of Brahma. So this is how the universe is fashioned. Now, age of the earth. So we know that the lower planetary systems are destroyed when the... So what this means is that since the, how old is our earth, we have to look at 6 manvantaras because this is 7th manvantara. And there are 7 sandhyas which have passed. So that way you can calculate. And this figure works out to be 1.97294908 billion years. So now similar age of the universe you can calculate out to be, and it works out to be 1.155.521972949108 trillion years. So this is the time duration. Now ultimately all this is from different perspectives how different things look. So in one millisecond of Brahmaji, actually our entire life is coming and going. So we can see different planets and we can have different sizes and we can have different ideas of whether life may be there or not. But actually our vision is so limited. We have to see through scriptural eyes, then we will see properly. So most of you know this story. So Brahmaji, I heard that your 1 second is our 100,000 years. Yes. So, and that your dollar is ours, $100,000. Yes. So then he says, can I have your $1 please? So what does Brahmaji say? 1 second. Wait a second, oh child. So wait a second this. Wait for 100,000 years. So actually speaking, life is so small for us. We know about this Lomash Rishi. You know, he would had the benediction that his one hair would fall in one Brahma's day. And he will die when all of his hair had fallen. And yet he didn't even build a hut for himself. And when his disciples wanted to build a hut for him, he said, what is the use? I'm going to die so soon. What is the use of building a hut? So, you know, his life is so long, but still he also feels that his life is temporary. And he wants to live, he wants to use all the time for self-realization. This is how everything in this world is temporary. No matter how much we try, we cannot change the essential nature of this world. Now, so actually our life is not very long. And the earlier we recognize it, the better it is for us. So it is said that life takes off when we understand how soon life takes us off. So life takes off when we understand how soon life takes us off. Life takes us off means we are here in the material world in a particular body, but we are not going to live here for long. Life is going to take us off from this world to another world. And when we understand, imagine if I have got a car, and with this car, say I'm in Mumbai and I have to go to Pune, and I have been told that you will have the car only for 2.5 hours. And I'll have to drive very fast if I'm to reach Pune. And I'm told that if I'm not able to reach Pune, then wherever I have reached, I'll have to drop the car over there. Then I'll have to flag another car, hire another car. And after that, only after I got adequate money, then I will be able to go on forward by another car. So then what will I do? Then I'll just move straight forward. I know that I'll be taken out of this car after the prescribed time. So let me move as fast as possible so that I can reach the destination as quickly as I can. But if it happens that I start fooling around, I see this site, I go to this hotel, I watch that movie, and then what will happen? Even before I got to one tenth of the distance of Pune, what, I'll be lost. In the sense that my car will be taken away and nothing will be left with me. So therefore, what I have to do is, I have to recognize that I have less time. Therefore, let me drive as fast as possible. Similarly, in our spiritual life, life takes off when we understand how soon life takes us off. Takes us off. So we'll be taken off by life from this car of the body and put in another body. So recognizing the temporary nature helps us to fix our minds on the eternal, whatever be our ashram, whatever be our situation. So now, main part of this verse is that a devotee transcends death. Now we wonder, what exactly does it mean for a devotee to transcend death? Is it something that can be logically understood? So we'll discuss it in these three phases, past, present and future. So we'll discuss the reactions that materialistic people have and how the reaction of devotees is different. So what is the example that Srila Prabhupada would often give for the difference between the death of a devotee and the death of a materialist? His favorite example was of a kitten. When a cat holds a kitten, his example would be that, actually speaking, when two people may be held, but one is held by love, the other is held by the fear of death. So in both cases, the holding is there, but the purpose is very different. And because the purpose is very different, the destination also is going to be very different. So the same cat might appear, but the cat has a kitten in its mouth and the cat has a rat in his mouth. So both of them feel entirely different. So similarly, Prabhupada would say that for a devotee, for a materialistic people, Krishna comes as time. And for a devotee, time comes as Krishna. That means time reveals himself as Krishna. So, what does it mean, time reveals himself as Krishna? That means a devotee is able to return to Krishna through time. And that's how a devotee is satisfied. So now, it may happen that a devotee may also feel fearful. How does it happen that actually I become detachment? I let up detachment. So we have to understand what utsahan, nishchayat and hiryat mean. So, utsahan, nishchayat, hiryat we will discuss later in more detail. But here let us focus on how we can go beyond the trauma of death through God consciousness. So death is something that happens to the body, and as long as the soul is attached to the body, the soul has to suffer the trauma of death. Let us see, now we know that the Garuda Puran says that when a person dies, that person gets chak chak chak. The pain is like 40,000 scorpion bites. Now, when the scriptures give this kind of figures, we have to understand they are meant to illustrate a particular point. Now, one scorpion bite is so stinging. It can be poisonous and it can be extremely painful. So 40,000 scorpion bites is immensely, intolerably, frighteningly fearful. So this way, by giving a quantification like this, we are impelled. I don't want to undergo this. What should I do? So now, is it precise that everybody will have to face exactly 40,000 scorpion bites pain? No, it depends on the person who is attached and how attached the person is to the body. But everybody will have to face the trauma of death. And this trauma is not at all pleasant to face. So people face suffering in three phases. One is sorrow about the past. When a person is about to die, at that time, person has sorrow about the past. Because actually when a person is about to die, everything that he or she has been attached to, that everything is going to be ripped away. Not just everything, but also everyone. And everything means everything. Even the body is going to be taken away from us. And there can be no bereavement greater than that. So thoughts are caught in the past. Oh, I had built this house, I had this family, I had these children, I had this spiritual whatever. I had all these things. And all of them are taken away. So definitely at the time of death, there is immense sorrow. Because one is losing everything that was dear to oneself. And then what about the present? At the present, the body is breaking down. If I have lung cancer and I am taking treatment, but the treatment is not working, then I am coughing constantly, even when I have to speak. And then I suffer in various ways because the body to which I am so attached is falling. It's falling down. It's just breaking apart. It's getting self-destroyed in many ways. Without the terrorists coming to attack to destroy it, just the greatest terrorist of time itself comes. And time destroys the body. And then for a materialistic person, in addition to the pain of present, there is the fear about future. So what is the fear about future? Because a materialistic person doesn't know what is going to happen after death. So because the person doesn't know what is going to happen after death, so am I going to exist? If I exist, where will I exist? Will I suffer? If I suffer, what kind of suffering will I have? None of these things are known. And because of that, if we are just staying in a house and we are evicted out of the house and then we're put in a van and we don't know where the van is going. Is it going to take us to lockup hall? Is it going to mental asylum? Is it going to get us to take a witness in a court for some disease, for some case that we were a witness to and we refused? None of this is known. So because of this, there is enormous suffering. Suffering due to the past attachments, present new challenges because the body is under pain, and the future uncertainties. But for a devotee, all these three get transcended. So how does it happen for a devotee? Sorrow about the past. A devotee actually gives up all material attachments, and a devotee tries to become attached to Krishna. When those devotees are successful in getting attached to Krishna, then they actually suffer from the bodily pains at the time of death far lesser, because they do not have much emotional attachment to things. their heart is primarily with Krishna. And because their heart is with Krishna, they have no lamentation about losing their attachment, losing their beloved ones. You see, they certainly love their family members, relatives, if they are grihastha. They take care of them, they are affectionate to them. But they ultimately love them because these are Krishna's children, these are Krishna's family members, and I am a caretaker on behalf of Krishna. So even their relatives and family members, their presence increases the devotee's devotion and dependence on Krishna. And in this way, the devotee doesn't have much to lose from the past. In fact, what the devotee loses is the material body, which is a source of so much misery and so much distraction. So on one side, the body causes misery at a physical level. But even if it is not causing misery at a physical level through various diseases, it through the sensual level keeps alluring us and keeps causing distraction to us. So that's the ISKCON desire tree. That is the explanation about how a materialistic person is suffering. But a devotee is not suffering because of the past attachments are lost. Or because the devotee doesn't have any material attachments in the past. All the material attachments are spiritualized. All everything material is used for Krishna's service. So there may be some sorrow because of separation from devotees. But then there is the eagerness to be reunited with Krishna and the eagerness with Krishna's community of pure devotees in the spiritual world. Now what about the pain at the present? Is the pain at present there for a devotee? Actually, when the body breaks down, a devotee may also take treatment. But there is a difference between the devotee suffering and non-devotee suffering. For a devotee, the suffering is not exactly a suffering. It's an inconvenience. If I fall down and I fracture my hand, that's a trouble for me. But if I'm going out in the vehicle and the vehicle gets a puncture, the puncture of the tire of my car and the fracture of my hand are not the same thing. Because actually the puncture of the car is about something external to me. But when a person becomes self-realized or moves towards spiritual advancement and self-realization, one understands even this body is external to me. So in a sense, the fracture of the hand is not much different from the puncture of the car. So Krishna also uses the word yantra rudhani mayaya. Yantra rudhani mayaya means that this body is like a machine, and because it is like a machine, so a devotee who sees it as a machine doesn't get affected when it starts deteriorating or it has some problems. Now if the car in which I'm going has got punctured, naturally I have to repair it. And it is a problem, but it is not a suffering in the sense that there is no emotional involvement unless I'm very attached to it. There is just a physical inconvenience. So for a devotee, problems are unavoidable, but suffering is avoidable. We can't avoid problems in this world. Things going wrong, things not going according to our order. But the associated miseries that come, they depend on how much you are emotionally entangled in them, those things. So to continue this example, suppose a person has a car, a brand new car, and is proudly driving in that car, and then comes to a red signal and stops, and suddenly, tuck, somebody hit the bumper from behind. The person screams. The person feels like, you know, beating that person. Actually, it's as if the car's bumper has just been slightly touched, but the person feels as if my heart has been torn apart. Because my car. Actually nothing has happened to the person, but because of the attachment, a lot has happened in the heart. And the person is agonized. Now suppose that person sells the car away and now is, say, driving another car, and then that old car is with somebody else, and that somebody else is driving the car, and then suddenly a truck comes and tuck, hits it severely from behind, and now it's not just a scratch on the bumper, there is actually complete, the backside has become crushed. Now still, will this person feel pain? Not really. Actually, there's some human concern will be there. Is somebody injured? But beyond that, the pain would have been there if it had been my car. It won't be there. Because the attachment is not there now. That car was sold away. That car doesn't belong to me. Now my car is here. So therefore, what happens to that car is not such a emotionally turbulent thing for me. similarly for a devotee, the body, the devotee understands this body is given ultimately by Krishna, but it is given through material nature, and material nature is actually using the body to give me my karmic reactions, good and bad. So as long as I am attached to the body, it's like I am in the car which I am attached to, and a slight hit causes me tremendous pain. But as I become detached from the body, then the amount of pain decreases, because the amount of emotional entanglement in the body decreases. It's just like a car, it is outside, that is hit, not my car, somebody else's car, a car that I was earlier using is hit. The person doesn't feel so much trouble or pain. Similarly, we don't feel so much trouble or pain when the body grows old. This doesn't mean that we don't feel any pain at all. We do feel, but it's more in the nature of inconvenience if we are advanced devotees. Harishwari Prabhu writes in his Transcendental Diary that when Srila Prabhupada would be in Mayapur, and if other devotees would be there while Prabhupada was taking massage, Prabhupada would be very self-conscious, would be a little bit more conscious and cautious. But if nobody would be there, then he would not like to talk at that time. He just become completely silent and become internally absorbed. And in the sense, he said, I would feel as if just like when a person goes to a scenic place, maybe a garden, very nice, beautiful, natural place, and the person has come in a car, the person drops the car off in a garage for you do the overhauling of the car, and I am going out for a walk to see the sights in the garden. So he said, I felt as if the Prabhupada had left his body with me to do some overhauling, and Prabhupada had gone out to see what's happening. He got out of the dham to relish the dham at a spiritual level. So Prabhupada was just lost in an internal absorption in the Supreme Lord. So that is how a pure devotee transcends the body, by absorption in Krishna. So because of that, for a devotee, the suffering at the physical level is much, much lesser. It's there, no doubt, but it's much lesser. So there are many wonderful Prabhupada disciples who have departed from this world, and as well as Giriraj Maharaj has compiled a book called Many, Many Moons about their life, how they have lived gloriously and they left gloriously. And we see many of them, they left in such extraordinary consciousness, utterly fearless even till the last moment. So that was how they were transcending death for all practical purposes. So there are many inspiring stories. I would like to share here the story of Sridhar Maharaj. But before I do that, let's look at fear about the future. Does a devotee have fear about the future? Not at all. A devotee welcomes future, because the devotee knows that actually I am going to return to Krishna. The very event that I have been waiting for so long, that is going to happen now. And the devotee looks forward to the future, in fact. And that's how the devotee transcends the fear of death overall. Transcends the trauma of death. So at a physical level, a devotee is not going to transcend it. Everybody has to suffer at a physical level. But by raising the consciousness above the physical level, one minimizes the pain that is there. Vishwacharya Thakur gives the example of how when a woman is married and is about to go to the groom's house, then she has some uncertainty, some fear, because she doesn't know anybody over there. She doesn't know her husband, she doesn't know her in-laws also. But so then there will be apprehension. But if that marriage has been preceded by a long courtship, and then she knows her groom very well, and they are in love with each other, then when she gets married, at that time, there is no apprehension, there is only anticipation, eager anticipation, because she is going to be reunited, because going to be united for life with her beloved. Similarly, he says that for a materialistic person, death means nothing is known about the future. There is naturally apprehension, like this extreme fear is there. But for a devotee, there's been a long courtship. The whole process of devotional service is in a sense a courtship. We're developing a relationship with Krishna. And then, in a sense, for a devotee, death is just a takeoff. That is not the termination, it is a transition. It's a transition from this level of existence to a higher level of existence. So a devotee looks forward and eagerly. In the Jagannath Ashtakam, it says, Haratvam samsaram duttaram asaram surapate. Haratvam papanam vitatim aparam yadavpate. So my dear Lord, please take me out of this samsara. Please free me from the ocean of sinful reactions that are there and take me back to you. So His Holiness Sridhar Maharaj, he had some severe liver problems. He was a very dynamic devotee who started preaching, who was introduced to Krishna consciousness actually by reading the Ishopanishad book itself. He got the book and he liked it very much. And then he heard from devotees that Srila Prabhupada wanted a lot of devotees in India to help in the preaching. So he came to India and he lived much of his life in India, in helping in the Juhu temple. And he was a very cheerful, although he was renounced and very devoted to Krishna, he was also very cheerful. So many of the Indian life members, traditional Hindus, they had the idea of a sadhu as a very grave, sober person. But Sridhar Maharaj was always joking and jolly, so they gave him the name Jolly Swami. He was throughout his life very cheerful. And then he was told at one time by a doctor that you have got some severe problem with the liver and you will die in a short while. And then he thought, okay, if that is the will of Krishna, that's I'll keep serving Krishna. And then somehow he lived on for over a dozen years. It was a miracle how it happened. His whole body was collapsing, but he just lived on, and then he was kept vigorously traveling and preaching. And then at one time when he was in Canada, at that time the doctor told him his liver is completely broken down. Now there's not much chance of any further. So he decided that he will stay with his disciples and give them association, and then he will depart there itself. So he and Indradhanu Maharaj were close friends. So Indradhanu Maharaj in South Africa, he called him. And Indradhanu Maharaj said, no, you should go back to Mayapur. Now all your life you have given yourself to others. Now it is the time for you to focus undistractedly on Krishna. And the holy dhams are meant just for that. So then when Indradhanu Maharaj insisted, they agreed. And Indradhanu Maharaj said, Sridhar Maharaj said, if you come with me, then we'll go together to Mayapur. They said, okay, we'll meet in London. I'll come to London, you also come to London. So both of them came to London together. And then they met in London. And they were staying in the London temple. At that time, before they were about to go to the flight, so Indradhanu Maharaj just came to Sridhar Maharaj's room. And Sridhar Maharaj has taken a bath. So he saw that his body was discolored. You know, there are different colored patches on his body. It basically looked like the blood was of a different color. What is it? He said, actually, those blood vessels have gone now. So all the small vessels have gone. When the big vessels, blood vessels go, I will go. Just talking casually, as if I'm going somewhere out for a walk or something like that. Utterly fearless. And when they were checking the tickets, just final baggage. So normally when American devotees come to India, generally come with a round ticket. Arriving at this date, departing at this date. So then Indradhanu Maharaj saw the ticket. Maharaj, your ticket is all wrong. It's just a one-way ticket. And then as he spoke it, he realized Sridhar Maharaj was not going to come back. He was going to Mayapur to leave his body. So he just checked his tongue and Sridhar Maharaj started laughing. Yes. He said, Krishna has given a one-way ticket back to Godhead. Yad gatva na nivartante tad dham paramam mama. So he just made a joke out of it. And then they went to the airport and somehow they got into the plane and the whole effort was very exhausting. It was in the final stages. So when he was in the hospital, the plane sitting, the pain became unbearable. So Sridhar Maharaj started moaning slightly. And then he gave some pills to him, some pain-killing pills to him. But then the air hostess came along. Is something wrong? And Sridhar Maharaj said, till now he's been moaning. He opened his eyes. He just looked at her and he says, there is always something wrong in this material world. And he started preaching to her about how this world is dukkhalam shashvatam. And he said, the best solution is to get out of this world and to go back to God. Yeah, makes sense. She was so affected by speaking. She says, it makes sense. Is that what you people are doing? She said, look at Indradhanu Maharaj's point. Yes, that is exactly what we are doing. That is getting out of this world and going back to God. He says, okay, very good. He says, and then to his surprise, Indradhanu Maharaj saw that Sridhar Maharaj reached out with his weak hand, took out a book and he gave it to her. If you want to know more, you can read this book. So even in the last moment she was doing this to him, she said, yes, I'll come and give you a donation. And she took the book. And then finally, when they reached Calcutta, the devotees had arranged for a car to take him from Calcutta to Mayapur. So some of his leading disciples were there. One of his leading disciples was there in the car. He was lying down on a stretcher on the backside. And Sridhar Maharaj started speaking to his disciple as if he represented all his disciples. He told, you know, all of you have assisted me so much in my service to the Srila Prabhupada. I am forever grateful to you. When I became a sannyasi, I felt that I had renounced the whole world. And the joys of family, which most people have, I would not have that. But when all of you came in my life, now I have so many sons and daughters. And you have in so many ways made me proud. I'm grateful to you. Please continue on with whatever Srila Prabhupada has given you. And he was appreciating the services of that devotee as well as other devotees. So it was a very intimate, loving exchange. And finally, when they reached Mayapur, at that time, it was the morning time when they were going to reach. So the devotees, Mayapur devotees, decided to cancel the Bhagavatam class. And that was the time when the GBC meetings were going on, just before Gaur Purnima. So they decided that everybody will be out to welcome Sridhar Maharaj. So right from the main Mayapur gate, Mayapur Chandradev temple premises gate, and especially the conch building where the devotees were staying outside the temple, there were devotees lined up everywhere. And then when Sridhar Maharaj reached there and he saw, you know, there are hundreds of devotees there doing kirtan to welcome him. It was like a warrior who has fought in glorious wars and has come back home. So the whole country has come to welcome that warrior to honor for whatever service he has done. So then they took him inside, and then he went and he had darshan of the deities, and then finally they took him to a room upstairs. And when they took him, he himself walked to all the rooms, to the room upstairs, and finally the whole effort was very exhausting because he had been in the flight, then in the train, and then with all the devotees around doing kirtan, walking and taking darshan of all the three deities. It's too exhausting, so he almost like fell unconscious. And because he had a lot of gas in his stomach because of the liver problem, so his stomach had also become bloated. So many of the devotees summoned a doctor, and a doctor came, and the doctor started placing stethoscope to see what it is. And Sridhar Maharaj came back to consciousness. He opened his eyes and looked around. And then he saw all the devotees looking so grave and somber. He looked at the doctor touching the stethoscope, and he said, "Doctor, is it a boy or a girl?" So, even at that time, he was just so humorous. And the Sridhar Maharaj told Nirmala Maharaj that I have got three desires. I want to reach Mayapur Dham. I want to be there for the installation of Panchatattva. And I want to be there for Gaur Purnima. So, by Lord Chaitanya Mahamasi, Krishna Mahamasi, all the three desires are fulfilled. He was there. You see the Panchatattva video. Although he was physically weak, he was there. Right on the altar in the Panchatattva installation, helping in the aarti, participating in the aarti of the deities. Then he was there for Gaur Purnima also. So then the devotees thought Gaur Purnima will be ideal time for him to depart. He said, "No, I am praying to Lord Chaitanya, do not depart at the time of Gaur Purnima." He said, "Why?" "Because I want this to be the festival of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I don't want this festival of Sridhar Swami. So I don't want the center to shift from the Lord to me." So even till the last moment, his consciousness was so selfless. So I was there in Mayapur at one time, gone for a camp. So he was there. So I had gone to meet him along with some other devotees. We asked him how he was feeling. So he said, "You know, India has a gas production company called ONGC, Oil Natural Gas Corporation." So he said, "There's so much gas in my stomach that ONGC can set up a plant over here. It'll be a profitable plant." So rather than complaining, I was so much pain and so many things, he made a joke out of it. And till the last days, he was cheerful, hearing Prabhupada's pastimes, inspiring devotees. And then finally, on Gadadhar Pandit's, on a holy day, he departed from early in the morning, beholding the beautiful forms of Radha Madhav, which had been put in beautiful lamination in his room. In the Brahma Murti, he departed from the world. And throughout, he was fearless. He just went through death as if it was nothing fearful. So actually, this is how a devotee can transcend death. And this is not just one. There are many examples like this of devotees departing from the world very gracefully. So, what happens, or what is happening over here? A devotee, the physical event of death is happening, but the devotee has transcended the pain. Because the consciousness is shifted to a higher reality, fixed on that higher reality. Some devotees may not depart so gracefully, but how they depart is not as important as where their consciousness is. If the consciousness, they have cultivated a lifetime practice of devotional service, of redirecting their consciousness towards Krishna, then the precise method, way of transition is not important as the destination of the transition. They are going to attain an auspicious destination. And all of us can attain the same destination if we also practice devotional service systematically. And the glory of the process of Krishna consciousness, which Shri Krishna, Shri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada have given us, is that actually this has enabled people from all over the world to become purified. Everyone is only Jayadvat Maharaj writes in Vyas Puja offering to Srila Prabhupada that, you know, if an eminent school, if there is a big exam, a very important exam, say in India there is an exam called IJE for getting into IIT, and there are coaching classes just for this, and the coaching classes let it die. You know, so many students from our coaching classes crack the JE, they top the JE. And that's a matter of pride for the coaching class. But in general, if we look at the system how it is, these coaching classes which give the top, give out toppers, actually they take in toppers also. That means, even in the coaching classes, if you have to join the coaching classes, they often have cut-off percentage. That only these people about, you should have this much merit, only then you can join. So what is happening? People who already have caliber, they are taken in, and then they are trained, and they achieve a lot. But imagine if there would be a coaching class, which says, you know, we will take all failures. You know, a person who have barely scraped to 10th standard exam, we will take them. And that coaching class transforms them into toppers. That would be something extraordinarily remarkable. So he said, Srila Prabhupada has given us Krishna consciousness which is like that. Of course, when Srila Prabhupada went to America and preached, there are many great souls who were seeking spirituality, who were ready to renounce the world for the sake of spirituality, and seriously seeking God. But many others were also people who had just rejected the world and were in many ways aimless. They had become hippies, and they were in situations which involve breaking all the regulative principles. So Prabhupada took them, and from there he elevated them, and he made them into exalted devotees who lived a life full of service to Krishna, and at the end they left in remembrance of Krishna. This is how this process, Sambhutya Amrita Mashnute, this verse description, is actually manifested in the way we see things in ISKCON also. So a devotee understands that the scriptures are not just an ancient book. They are a living reality, and they are a lived reality. They are a living reality for those who are living according to it, and they will be a lived reality for us if we try to live according to it. So, to summarize, we discussed today about how everything in this world is temporary, and in that connection we discussed the various time scales. And we discussed also about the Western model of time, which is linear, and the Vedic model of time, which is cyclic, and how that reflects the Vedic model reflects a natural reality. And then after discussing figures about Brahmaji and other the lifespan, then we discussed about how a materialist suffers at the time of death because of sorrow at losing all the attachments, pain because the body is breaking down, and fear because the future is unknown. A devotee's sorrow is much lesser because there are no attachments to material things left. The pain is much lesser because the body is a vehicle whose breakdown is more of an inconvenience than a suffering. And there is very little fear because a devotee knows that we are going to be ultimately reunited with Krishna. And then we discuss how this has been done by Srila Prabhupada through his Krishna consciousness movement, where he has got many, many moons. Many, many moons refers to Janaki Pandita saying that Ekas Chandastamo Hanti Nichitaraha Sahasrasha, that even one moon is better than hundreds of stars, because one moon can illuminate the whole sky. So Srila Prabhupada used the saying to say that I want one glorious disciple, even that is enough. I don't need hundreds of namesake disciples. But Prabhupada said, Krishna has been so kind to me that he has given me many, many moons, given me many illustrious disciples. So you see how Srila Prabhupada has taken people from all backgrounds, even if they were non-spiritual, anti-spiritual, and elevated them to the highest levels of spiritual consciousness. Therefore, demonstrating this verse, Sambhutya Amrita Mashnate. Thank you very much. श्री शोपनिषद की जय, श्री प्रभुपाद की जय, गौर भक्तवृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंदे।